everybody. Welcome to episode 90 of Cracking the Spine. I'm bringing it in. That's what I do because I'm Sean, and I didn't bring in the last one.
Sure didn't.
I'm Zane.
I'm Josh.
And because of Halloween, we had a lot of ideas for what we wanted to do for episode 89. Woo! And they were all spooky. But we went a little long on the last one, and we don't want to bore you guys, so we decided to split it into two. Also, this gives us more content for you guys to download and
quit
giving a shit about how long it's been between episodes.
Yo.
Just saying.
They can give us whatever they want. Shit, pee, poop.
Stop.
No, please. You're not the one that gets packages from these people.
Money.
Send us the money in the mail,
candy.
But not the shit or pee or poop.
All right? Yeah, they won't let you do that. Thanks, mail service.
Or female service. Quit reading my emails, dude. It's not time yet.
I'm just fingering your phone so it doesn't close.
Spoilers.
Gross. But what we're going to do this one is a little bit more in line with what we've done with holidays past, which is, I don't want to call it dramatic readings, because they're not dramatic, but we're going to do readings of texts that
Thanks for telling me, guys.
That other people have written. Maybe for us, maybe not. Feel free to weigh in at any point, guys. It's not a monologue.
Sean said.
I'm totally prepared for a reading.
Unsurprisingly.
Guys.
Josh did not come prepared.
Well, it's hard to have a reading when you don't, you know, read.
Oh, that old chestnut. Josh can't do anything right.
All right. So
thanks, Dad.
Stick around, because in the next segment, Josh is going to do something probably not right. We'll be right back.
I'm next, Josh.
Who was the famous football person of 90?
Corey Simon.
There it is.
Who cares?
Also, there it is.
Alright, so first
him.
Up is Josh.
Hi, I'll be reading an email sent to us to our email, which is crackingthespineshow@gmail.com.
Nicely done, Josh.
I had to reach far back into my brain, thanks, to find that one.
And who's the email from?
It is from Christian Harris. Was that a cat horn? Sweet. Okay. It's called Getting Back Into Reading / Recommendations? Question mark.
Ooh.
Hey guys, to be honest, I followed Josh to this podcast, and even then it has taken me a while to start going through it. Thank you for following me to this podcast.
That was a parenthetical. That was not part of the email.
I'm me now. I can't do a voice. Listening to
episode... Mark Twain.
No, he doesn't... Christian is not a Mark Twain-y name.
All right, all right.
I'm listening to episode...
Came all this way from Mark Twain.
I'm listening to episode 21 as I write this, and I'm loving every minute of it. Dude, it gets so much better after 21.
For real, too.
Like, for real. I'm not telling you a joke. I haven't read too much in a long time. In my teenage years, I was big into Jim Butcher's The Dresden Files. I haven't revisited them since. Please be gentle if they are actually quite terrible. Well, it's your opinion, man, you know?
Never read them, so
never did
I'm going to assume they're terrible.
Surprise, I never read
the
them.
Stuff I've never read. Sucks.
Damn, dude. Recently, I've been making my way through Stephen King's works.
That'll do.
I started with The Shining, which I ended up stepping away from because being a big fan of the film, which is really better than the book, the novel just didn't grab me the same way.
Wait, was that being better than the book yours or his?
I read The Gunslinger and loved it. And am now making my way through it, slowly but surely. I've been adding a lot of stuff from the podcast to an Amazon wishlist to keep track of the ones that sound interesting. A Head Full of Ghosts, that's the Zane book. The Fold.
Zane book.
I read that one, didn't I?
Yeah.
Yeah, you read that
one. I read that one. That was okay.
Yeah, remember when you read books?
We have evidence of it.
Admittedly!
Even this guy remembers.
Yeah, Christian remembers.
I read Pepperidge Farm remembers.
Pepperidge Farm remembers. Admittedly, I also, before listening to the podcast, bought Ready Player One after countless recommendations from friends who shouldn't be your friends anymore, and even my father, who you should just get rid of him. I'm still going to at least give it a try, despite Sean's mind-blowing dramatic reading.
I feel bad for people who, like, I feel bad that this kid bought Ready Player One and was, like, all excited to read it. and then listened to the podcast and was like, should I not be excited?
I don't feel bad for a second. It's a piece of shit.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible.
If you bought a piece of shit, it's not my fault that you have a piece of shit in your house.
Right. You should.
But I'm glad that you're at least leafing through shit.
Yeah. It's good to read, I guess, that book.
DJ R2-D2.
I can't wait till the movie comes out and that scene comes on and everyone claps in the movie theater like a bunch of slack-jawed idiots. Anyway, having read so little, I have a hard time trying to find more of what I might like. I feel you on that one. That's how I feel all the time. Is there any chance I could have some recommendations to give more information, some things that I have my eye on that you haven't mentioned on the podcast yet are Annihilation by Jeff Vandermeer, Dune by Frank Herbert, and Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson. Thanks a lot, folks. Keep doing great stuff, Chris. Thank you, Chris.
Have I really never mentioned Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson?
If he's only on episode 21.
I feel like
okay,
we did.
Fair enough.
Because I'm pretty sure we talk about Snow Crash a lot.
I'm going to say, you should read Snow Crash.
Yeah.
Before you read Ready Player One.
And Dune, you should read, too.
See, now Dune, I hesitate to turn people onto Dune because it's a little weird. It's an undertaking. It's a whole thing. Yeah. I've heard that Annihilation by Vandermeer is supposed to be phenomenal. Haven't read it myself. One I will toss out for everybody, a little freebie for the listeners that I haven't talked about on the show because it's been a week.
Oh, boy.
One week.
It's called Dark Matter by Blake Crouch. Wait, maybe I did talk about this
before.
You might
have.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, you might have.
Yeah, that I'm saying it out loud, I think I have.
It's also a show name, isn't it? On Sci-Fi Channel.
Yes.
Dark Matter? Is that right?
Yes, I want to say yes.
Yeah.
Blake Crouch did create a show called Wandering Pines or Whispering Pines?
Yeah.
Wandering Pines, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
It's a quantum time-traveling thriller.
That's awesome.
So, that's for you.
So they go, it's like Sliders, they go to like a different time.
Yeah, I like that. That's actually a really apt parallel, Josh.
Sliders.
Aw, remember Josh was good at something?
I do.
It happens rarely.
Good job.
A break! I was just reading! Hello, welcome back to episode 90 of Cracking the Spine Show. I'm Josh.
I'm Zane.
And I'm Sean, and for my reading tonight, I brought a story. It's a story from a new author. It's his first novel. It's actually a collection of short stories. His name is Alexander Weinstein,
okay.
And the book is called Children of the New World. And I would recommend strongly getting your hands on this book. Each story in this reads like it could be an episode of Black Mirror. The Netflix show of spookiness.
The new Twilight Zone.
And when I read this story, all I could think was it reminded me a lot of the kind of story that Zane would read because it feels to me like a Ray Bradbury short story.
So you're trying to one-up Zane.
I'm trying to keep pace with Zane.
Good luck, dude. I read an email. How do you think I feel?
Like an idiot. Like all right, keep going.
So tonight's story is called Rocket Night by Alexander Weinstein.
Rocket Night!
It was rocket night at our daughter's elementary school, the night when parents, students, and administrators gather to place the least liked child in a rocket and shoot him into the stars.
It would be me.
Last year, we placed Laura Jackson into the capsule, a short, squat girl known for the limp dresses that hung crookedly on her body. The previous year, we'd sent off a boy from India whose name none of us could remember.
Jeez.
Rocket night falls in late October when the earth is covered by leaves. Our children have begun to lay out their Halloween costumes, and their sweaters are heavy with the scent of autumn. It's late enough into the school year for us to get the scent of the best children to send off. Alliances are made early at Rose Hill. Our children gather in the mornings to share their secrets on the playgrounds, while the other children, those with stars and galaxies in their futures, can be seen at the edges of the field, playing alone with sticks, or staring into mud puddles at drowned worms. In the school gymnasium, we mingle in the warm glow of lacquered floors, surrounded by wooden bleachers and parallel bars, talking about soccer games, math homework, and the difficulty of finding time for errands with our children's busy schedules.
I know what that's like.
Our kids run the perimeter, some playing tag, others collecting in clusters of boys around the fifth graders with portable game consoles, the girls across the room in their own clusters. Susan Beach brought her famous home-baked cupcakes. The Stowes brought Hawaiian punch. And we brought plastic cups and cocktail napkins and placed them on the table among the baked goods and apple slices. The boy to be sent off, I believe his name was Daniel, stood near his parents, holding his mother's skirt, looking unkempt. One could immediately see the reason he'd been chosen. The mildewed scent of thrift stores clung to his corduroys, and his collar sat askew, revealing the small white undershirt beneath. His brown slacks were held up by an oversized belt, the end of which flopped lazily from his side. The boy, our daughter told us, brought stubby pencils to school, whose chewed-up ends got stuck in sharpeners. He had the habit of picking his nose and wiping it on his pants. His lunches were nothing more than stale crackers and a warm box of chocolate milk. There was a smear of cupcake frosting on the corner of his mouth, and upon seeing this detail, we knew our children had chosen well.
Oh, that the kids pick? Dumb.
He was the kid to the stars.
He was the sort of child who makes one proud of one's own children.
I know what that's like.
And when we looked over to our daughter, who was holding court with a devil's square, tightening them with spreading fingers within the folded paper while counting the letters. O-R-A-N-G-E. At 8 o'clock, the principal took the stage beneath the basketball hoop, a whine from the microphone as he adjusted it. He turned to us with open arms and welcomed parents and students to another year at Rose Hill. He thanked Susan for her cupcakes and all of us for our contributions to the evening's festivities. Then, forgetting the boy's name, he turned to the family and said, "We hope your child's journey into space will be a joyful one." We all applauded. His parents applauded less than others, looking a bit pale, but parents of the chosen often seem pale. They are the sort of people who come to soccer games and sit alone in the stands, a gloomy sadness hanging over them, whose cars make the most noise when they pull into our school's parking lot, and whose faces, within the automobile's dark interiors, remind us of a sorrow none of us wish to share. His speech delivered, the principal invited us to join him on the playground, where the capsule sat, cockpit open, its silver sides illuminated by the glow from the launch tower. It's a truth that the child to be sent into space grows reticent upon seeing the glowing tower and the gaping, casket-like rocket. We saw the small boy cling to his mother, unwilling to leave her side, and so we let our children loose. I watched my daughter pry the boy's fingers from his mother's leg as two larger fifth graders seized his waist and dragged him away. The nurse, a kindly woman, helped to subdue the parents. She took the mother aside and whispered to her while the gym coach placed a meaty hand on the father's shoulder and assured him the capsule was stocked with water and food tablets, plenty to last the boy a long time into the future. To be honest, it's a mystery how long such supplies last. It's a small compartment within that capsule, and we are all aware funding was cut to our district earlier this year. But we assured them there was nothing to fear. The boy, if hungry for company, had a small microphone inside the shell, which would allow him to speak to himself about his journey, his thoughts, and the mysteries of the universe.
Oh boy.
The boy was strapped into the capsule, his hands secured, and he looked out at us. He spoke then, for the first and only time that night. He asked if he might have one of his pencils with him. It was in his pencil box, he said, the one with a brown bear eraser. The principal assured him that he wouldn't need it in outer space, and the custodian noted that the request was moot, as the boy's desk had been emptied earlier that day. So they closed the cover. All we could see was the smudge of the boy's face pressed against the porthole. When the rocket blasted off, it made us all take an involuntary step backwards, the light of the flames illuminating the wonder upon our children's faces. The capsule rose from the playground, leaving behind our swing sets and jungle gym, rising higher, until it was sparkling marble in the night sky, and then, finally, gone. We sighed with awe, some applauded, and then we made our rounds, wishing one another good night, arranging playdates, and returning to our cars. Those of us on the PTO remained to put the gymnasium back in order for the next morning, and the boy faded from our thoughts, replaced by the lateness of the evening and the pressure of delayed bedtime schedules. I had all but forgotten about the child by the time I laid our sleeping daughter on her bed. And yet, when I took out the recycling that night, I paused beneath the street lamps of our cul-de-sac and thought of all the children high above. I imagined them drifting alone up there, speaking into their microphones, reporting to themselves about the depths of the unknown.
Oh my god.
And that's how I came to this planet.
Rocket Knight.
Yo, joke's on them.
Yeah, I would those rather kids be are in
there. Alien ambassadors now. Yeah,
that's fucked up, man.
Fucking love that story.
Is it because you want to send your child into space?
No, because I've been to enough
school events. Stupid, and I'm like, shitty, yeah.
It's not that far from the pale of where we're going.
Yeah, man.
Take that a break.
That was a good story, right? Sean.
I liked it. I'm going to steal this book.
Yeah, okay. Steal it and not read it.
Yep.
Welcome back to episode 90. That's the 10th 9 episodes that we've done. If we were a base 9 society.
Base 9. Thanks for inventing zero, Arabia.
Prince Ali, yes it is. Anyway, all right, no. That's what I know about Arabian culture, you guys.
Yeah, there you go.
All right.
With our final reading of the evening, Zane's
going to read.
I'm reading The Crowd by Ray Bradbury. It was written in 1943.
That was the year Sean was born.
Don't I know it.
Checks out. Shut up, Josh. Go ahead, Zane.
Mr. Spallner put his hands over his face. There was the feeling of movement in space, the beautifully tortured scream, the impact and tumbling of the car with wall, through wall, over and down like a toy, and him hurled out of it. Then, silence. The crowd came running. Faintly, where he lay, he heard them running. He could tell their ages and their sizes by the sound of their numerous feet over the summer grass and on the lined pavement, and over the asphalt street, and picking through the cluttered bricks to where his car hung half into the night sky, still spinning its wheels with a senseless centrifuge. Where the crowd came from, he didn't know. He struggled to remain aware, and then the crowd faces hemmed in upon him, hung over like the large, glowing leaves of downbent trees. They were a ring of shifting, compressing, changing faces over him, looking down, reading the time of his life or death by his face, making his face into a moon dial where the moon cast a shadow from his nose out upon his cheek to tell the time of breathing or not breathing any more ever. How swiftly a crowd comes, he thought, like the iris of an eye compressing in out of nowhere. A siren, a police voice, movement. Blood trickled from his lips, and he was being moved into an ambulance.
Gross.
Someone said, "Is he dead?" And someone else said, "No, he's not dead." And a third person said, "He won't die, he's not going to die." And he saw the faces of the crowd beyond him in the night, and he knew by their expressions that he wouldn't die. And that was strange. He saw a man's face, thin, bright, pale. The man swallowed and bit his lips, very sick. There was a small woman, too, with red hair and too much red on her cheeks and lips, and a little boy with a freckled face, others' faces, an old man with a wrinkled upper lip, an old woman with a mole upon her chin. They had all come from where? Houses, cars, alleys, from the immediate and the accident-shocked world, out of alleys and out of hotels and out of streetcars and seemingly out of nothing they came. The crowd looked at him, and he looked back at them and did not like them at all. There was a vast wrongness to them. He couldn't put his finger on it. They were far worse than this machine-made thing that happened to him now. The ambulance doors slammed. Through the windows, he saw the crowd looking in. That crowd that always came so fast, so strangely fast, to form a circle, to peer down, to probe, to gawk, to question, to point, to disturb, to spoil the privacy of a man's agony by their frank curiosity. The ambulance drove off. He sank back, and their faces still stared into his face, even with his eyes shut. The car wheels spun in his mind for days. One wheel, four wheels, spinning, and whirring, around and around. He knew it was wrong. Something wrong with the wheels and the whole accident and the running of feet and the curiosity. The crowd faces mixed and spun into the wild rotation of the wheels. He awoke. Sunlight. A hospital room. A hand taking his pulse. How do you feel? Asked the doctor. The wheels faded away. Mr. Spallner looked around. Fine, I guess. He tried to find words about the accident. Doctor? Yes. That crowd, was it last night? 2 days ago. You've been here since Thursday. You're all right, though. You're doing fine. Don't try and get up. That crowd, something about wheels, too. Do accidents make people, well, a little off? Temporarily, sometimes. He lay staring up at the doctor. Does it hurt your time sense? Panic sometimes does. Makes a minute seem like an hour, or maybe an hour seem like a minute? Yes. Let me tell you then. He felt the bed under him, the sunlight on his face. You'll think I'm crazy. I was driving too fast, I know. I'm sorry now. I jumped the curb and hit that wall. I was hurt and numb, I know, but I still remember things. Mostly the crowd. He waited a moment and then decided to go on, for suddenly he knew what it was that bothered him. The crowd got there too quickly. 30 seconds after the smash, they were all standing over me and staring at me. It's not right they should run that fast, so late at night. You only think it was 30 seconds, said the doctor. It was probably 3 or 4 minutes. Your senses... Yeah, I know, my senses. The accident. But I was conscious. I remember one thing that puts it all together and makes it funny. God, so damned funny. The wheels of my car, upside down. The wheels were still spinning when the crowd got there. The doctor smiled. The man in bed went on. I'm positive. The wheels were spinning, and spinning fast. The front wheels. Wheels don't spin very long. Friction cuts them down. And these were really spinning. You're confused, said the doctor. I'm not confused. That street was empty, not a soul in sight. And then the accident and the wheels still spinning and all those faces over me, quick, in no time. And the way they looked down at me, I knew I wouldn't die. Simple shock, said the doctor, walking away into the sunlight. They released him from the hospital 2 weeks later. He rode home in a taxi. People had come to visit him during his 2 weeks on his back. And to all of them, he had told his story, the accident, the spinning wheels, the crowd. They had all laughed with him concerning it and passed it off. He leaned forward and tapped on the taxi window. What's wrong? The cabbie looked back. Sorry, boss, this is one hell of a town to drive in. Got an accident up ahead. Want me to detour? Yes. No. No. Wait. Go ahead. Let's take a look. The cab moved forward, honking. Funny damn thing, said the cabbie. Hey, you! Get that flea trap out the way. Quieter. Funny thing. More damn people. Nosy people. Mr. Spallner looked down and watched his fingers tremble on his knee. You notice that too? Sure, said the cabbie. All the time. There's always a crowd. You'd think it was their own mother that got killed. They come running awfully fast, said the man in the back of the cab. Same way with a fire or an explosion. Nobody around. Boom. Lots of people around. I don't know. Ever seen an accident at night? The cabbie nodded. Sure. Don't make no difference. There's always a crowd. The wreck came in view. A body lay on the pavement. You knew there was a body even if you couldn't see it because of the crowd. The crowd with its back toward him as he sat in the rear of the cab, with its back toward him. He opened the window and almost started to yell, but he didn't have the nerve. If he yelled, they might turn around, and he was afraid to see their faces. I seem to have a penchant for accidents, he said in his office. It was late afternoon. His friend sat across the desk from him, listening. I got out of the hospital this morning, and first thing on the way home, we detoured around a wreck. Things run in cycles, said Morgan. Let me tell you about my accident. I've heard it. Heard it all. But it was funny, you must admit. I must admit. Now, how about a drink? They talked on for half an hour or more. All the while they talked, at the back of Spallner's brain, a small watch ticked. A watch that never needed winding. It was the memory of a few little things. Wheels and faces. At about 5:30, there was a hard metal noise in the street. Morgan nodded and looked out and down. What did I tell you? Cycles. A truck in a cream-colored Cadillac. Yes, yes. Spallner walked to the window. He was very cold, and as he stood there, he looked at his watch, the small minute hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 seconds. People running. 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. From all over, people came running. 15, 16, 17, 18 seconds. More people, more cars, more horns blowing. Curiously distant, Spallner looked upon the scene as an explosion in reverse. The fragments of the detonation sucked back to the point of impulsion. 19, 20, 21 seconds, and the crowd was there. Spallner made a gesture down at them, wordless. The crowd had gathered so fast. He saw a woman's body a moment before the crowd swallowed it up. Morgan said, "You look lousy. Here, finish your drink." "I'm all right. I'm all right. Let me alone. I'm all right. Can you see those people? Can you see any of them? I wish we could see them closer." Morgan cried out, "Where in the hell are you going?" Spawner was out the door, Morgan after him, and down the stairs as rapidly as possible. "Come along and hurry." "Take it easy. You're not a well man." They walked out on the street. Spawner pushed his way forward. He thought he saw a red-haired woman with too much red color on her cheeks and lips. "There," he turned wildly to Morgan. "Did you see her?" "See who?" "Damn it, she's gone. The crowd closed in." The crowd was all around, breathing and looking and shuffling and mixing and mumbling, getting in the way when he tried to shove through. Evidently, the red-haired woman had seen him coming and run off. He saw another familiar face, a little freckled boy. But there are many freckled boys in the world, and anyway, it was no use. Before Spawner reached him, this little boy ran away and vanished among the people. "Is she dead?" a voice asked. "Is she dead?" "She's dying," someone else replied. "She'll be dead before the ambulance arrives. They shouldn't have moved her. They shouldn't have moved her." All the crowd faces, familiar yet unfamiliar, bending over, looking down, looking down. "Hey, mister, stop pushing. Who you shoving, buddy?" Spawner came back out, and Morgan caught hold of him before he fell. "You damned fool, you're still sick. Why in hell you'd have to come down here?" Morgan demanded. "I don't know. I really don't know. They moved her, Morgan. Someone moved her. You should never move a traffic victim. It kills them. It kills them." "Yeah, that's the way with people. The idiots." Spawner arranged the newspaper clippings carefully. Morgan looked at them. "What's the idea? Ever since your accident, you think every traffic scramble is part of you. What are these? Clippings of motor car crack-ups and photos. Look at them. Not at the cars," said Spawner, "but at the crowds around the cars," he pointed. "Here, compare this photo of a wreck in the Wilshire district with one in Westwood. No resemblance. But now take this Westwood picture and align it with one taken in the Westwood district 10 years ago. Again, he motioned. "This woman is in both pictures. Coincidence. The woman happened to be there once in 1936, again in 1946. A coincidence once, maybe, but 12 times over a period of 10 years when the accidents occurred as much as 3 miles from one another? No. Here." He dealt out a dozen photographs. "She's in all of these. Maybe she's perverted. She's more than that. How does she happen to be there so quickly after each accident? And why does she wear the same clothes and pictures taken over a period of a decade? I'll be damned, so she does. And last of all, why was she standing over me the night of my accident 2 weeks ago?" They had a drink. Morgan went over the files. "Would you do hire a clipping service while you were in the hospital to go back through the newspapers for you?" Spawner nodded. Morgan sipped his drink. It was getting
clipping
late.
Service. I was going to say, clipping service.
1943. The streetlights were coming on in the streets below the office. "What does all this add up to?" "I don't know," said Spawner, "except that there's a universal law about accidents. Crowds gather. They always gather. And like you and me, people have wondered year after year why they gathered so quickly and how. I know the answer. Here it is." He flung the clippings down. "It frightens me. These people, mightn't they be thrill hunters, perverted sensationalists with a carnal lust for blood and morbidity?" Spawner shrugged. "Does that explain their being at all the accidents? Notice, they stick to certain territories. A Brentwood accident will bring out one group. A Huntington Park, another. But there's a norm for faces. A certain percentage appear at each wreck." Morgan said, "They're not all the same faces, are they?" "Naturally not. Accidents draw normal people, too, in the course of time. But these, I find, are always the first ones there." "Who are they? What do they want? You keep hinting and never telling. Good Lord, you must have some idea. You've scared yourself, and now you've got me jumping." "I've tried getting to them, but someone always trips me up. I'm always too late. They slip into the crowd and vanish. The crowd seems to offer protection to some of its members. They see me coming." "Sounds like some sort of clique." "They have the one thing in common. They always show up together. At a fire or an explosion or on the sidelines of a war. At any public demonstration of this thing called death. Vultures, hyenas, or saints. I don't know which they are. I just don't know. But I'm going to the police with it this evening. It's gone on long enough. One of them shifted that woman's body today. They shouldn't have touched her. It killed her." He placed the clippings in a briefcase. Morgan got up and slipped into his coat. Spawner clicked the briefcase shut. "Or, I just happen to think." "What?" "Maybe they wanted her dead." "Why?" "Who knows? Come along?" "Sorry, it's late. I'll see you tomorrow. Luck." They went out together. Give my regards to the cops. Think they'll believe you? Oh, they'll believe me, all right. Good night. Spawner took it slow, driving downtown. I want to get there, he told himself, alive. He was rather shocked, but not surprised somehow, when the truck came rolling out of an alley straight at him. He was just congratulating himself on his keen sense of observation and talking out what he would say to the police in his mind when the truck smashed into his car. It wasn't really his car. That was the disheartening thing about it. In a preoccupied mood, he was tossed first this way and then that way while he thought, what a shame. Morgan has gone and lent me his extra car for a few days until my other car is fixed, and now here I go again. The windshield hammered back into his face. He was forced back and forth in several lightning jerks. Then all motion stopped and all noise stopped, and only pain filled him up. He heard their feet running and running and running. He fumbled with the car door. It clicked. He fell out upon the pavement drunkenly and lay, ear to the asphalt, listening to them coming. It was like a great rainstorm with many drops, heavy and light and medium, touching the earth. He waited a few seconds and listened to their coming and their arrival. Then, weakly, expectantly, he rolled his head up and looked. The crowd was there. He could smell their breaths, the mingled odors of many people sucking and sucking on the air a man needs to live by. They crowded and jostled and sucked all the air up from around his gasping face until he tried to tell them to move back. They were making him live in a vacuum. His head was bleeding very badly. He tried to move and he realized something was wrong with his spine. He hadn't felt much at the impact, but his spine was hurt. He didn't dare move. He couldn't speak. Opening his mouth, nothing came out but a gagging. Someone said, give me a hand. We'll roll him over and lift him into a more comfortable position. Spawner's brain burst apart. No, don't move me. We'll move him, said the voice casually. You idiots, you'll kill me, don't. But he could not say any of this out loud. He could only think it. Hands took hold of him. They started to lift him. He cried out and nausea choked him up. They straightened him out into a ramrod of agony. Two men did it. One of them was thin, bright, pale, alert, a young man. The other man was very old and had a wrinkled upper lip. He had seen their faces before. A familiar voice said, is he dead? Another voice, a memorable voice, responded, no, not yet, but he will be dead before the ambulance arrives. It was all a very silly, mad plot, like every accident. He squealed hysterically at the solid wall of faces. They were all around him, these judges and jurors with the faces he had seen before. Through his pain, he counted their faces. The freckled boy, the old man with the wrinkled upper lip, the red-haired, red-cheeked woman, an old woman with a mole on her chin. I know what you're here for, he thought. You're here just as you're at all accidents, to make certain the right ones live and the right ones die. That's why you lifted me. You knew it would kill. You knew I'd live if you left me alone. And that's the way it's been since time began, when crowds gather. You murder much easier this way. Your alibi is very simple. You didn't know it was dangerous to move a hurt man. You didn't mean to hurt him. He looked at them, above him, and he was curious as a man under deep water looking up at people on a bridge. Who are you? Where do you come from, and how do you get here so soon? You're the crowd that's always in the way, using up good air that a dying man's lungs are in need of, using up space he should be using to lie in, alone, tramping on people to make sure they die. That's you. I know all of you. It was like a polite monologue. They said nothing. Faces. The old man, the red-haired woman. Someone picked up his briefcase. Whose is this? It's mine. It's evidence against all of you. Eyes inverted over him. Shiny eyes under tousled hair, under hats. Faces. Somewhere, a siren. The ambulance was coming. But, looking at their faces, the construction, the cast, the form of the faces, Spawner saw it was too late. He read it in their faces. They knew. He tried to speak. A little bit got out. It looks like I'll be joining up with you. I guess I'll be a member of your group now. He closed his eyes then and waited for the coroner.
He was done. They were dead people.
Yo.
They were fucking dead people.
Fuck you, Zane. Once again, doing a kick-ass job with
Great
Ray Bradbury.
Great job, Zane.
Thank you, Ray Bradbury.
Thank you, Ray
I
Bradbury.
Love ghost. You, Ray Bradbury's ghost, who's in the crowd now.
This story's almost 80 years old. Think about that.
It's almost as old as you are.
Almost.
Even back then, people hated people.
Yeah. And there was, like, way less of them. Especially in 1943. People were dying like crazy in 1943.
True story.
Like, a lot of people were dead.
All right.
Happy Halloween, Thanksgiving.
Spooky turkey.